wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, this week we've got quite the selection of things to talk about. And we're starting off with black holes and neutron stars and how black holes do all these crazy things.
Yeah, so we've talked about gravitational waves before in this show. You can think of them as another way of looking out at the universe. So most commonly we use electromagnetic waves, so optical waves, radio waves, microwaves, whatever, to look out and see what's going on in the universe. Gravitational waves are something completely different. They're ripples in space itself. So the actual space is expanding and contracting and moving at light speed towards us. And these gravitational waves are formed in really, really intense, you know, cataclysmic processes that occur out in the universe. And the sort of the two big daddies, I guess, of the universe are black holes and neutron stars. And these are incredibly dense, incredibly heavy, and they tend to pull things into themselves. And when that happens, there's a release of gravitational waves, which a few million or billion years later pass through the Earth, and we can spot them. And there's observatories, three observatories now, two in America, one in Europe, around the world that can observe these gravitational waves. And they've seen collisions between two black holes, and they've seen collisions between two neutron stars. But no one until recently had actually seen collisions between a black hole and a neutron star. And for various complicated reasons that I really don't understand, physicists are very interested in this because it could reveal a lot about the structure of black holes and neutron stars and maybe some new physics. And so so what's happened is that they've now managed to see two of these events, they think. They've managed to identify the relative sizes of the black hole and the neutron star. So I'm just looking through my notes here. The stronger of the two signals, so they spotted a couple of signals. The stronger of those was triggered in all three observatories, gravitational wave observatories, in January last year. And they indicate that a black hole, which was about the mass of about six of our suns, was basically eating a neutron star weighing about 1.5 the mass of our suns. And then 10 days earlier, there was a weaker signal. A black hole of about 9 solar masses was merging with a neutron star of about 2 solar masses. Now, both of these occurred about a billion light years away, so that means a billion years ago, roughly. This has just recently been reported. Now, what's interesting here is that these mergers of a black hole and a neutron star didn't emit any light, or if it did, we didn't see it. This could be because they were so far away, or it could be because the black hole just swallowed the neutron star whole.
I was going to say, black holes usually don't have a lot of light going on.
No, but when things fall into black holes, they tend to get ripped apart. And when that happens, when material gets ripped apart, it emits a lot of light. You often see these in using regular telescopes. But these two events, there was no visible or radio observation of these events. And this was surprising, but it could be explained if, like I said, the black hole, instead of ripping the neutron star apart, just basically took a one big gulp and swallowed it whole. And that apparently is possible. So black holes spin at a certain rate. Some spin very, very fast.
I didn't even know they moved until today.
Well, there you go. They spin, yeah. And some spin more slowly. And if the black hole is spinning quite slowly, apparently it's possible for it to just basically swallow a star in one gulp, which sort of points to how big these things are and how strange.
It's very hard to comprehend.
Yeah. And so what they think is that this black hole was a slowly spinning black hole, took one big gulp, and was able to swallow this star hole. And so had we only had electromagnetic wave telescopes, which is what we usually have, then we wouldn't have seen this at all. And it's only because we're now basically looking at the universe through a completely new set of eyes, I guess these gravitational waves, then we can actually see these events and actually learn something about them.
Wow. Well, let's head back to Earth and going sort of slightly more microscopic. And we're talking about the CRISPR gene. Now, I'm a big fan of the CRISPR gene and everything it can sort of do. And in this case, it's being used to treat, I'm probably going to butcher this, but transthyretin amyloidosis.
Okay, so I'm probably going to butcher this as well, but I said transthyretin amyloidosis, I think. Amyloidosis.
Medicine words are hard.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about CRISPR. What's happening here?
Yeah, so CRISPR is a revolutionary gene editing a method that basically enables researchers to snip bits out of the genetic code and stitch them back together again, and with really, really high precision. And so far, CRISPR has only been used outside of the body. So they take cells, they administer this procedure, and the genes are edited, and then they can be put back into the body, presumably. But preliminary results from a landmark clinical trial suggest that this CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, as it's called, can be deployed directly into the body to treat disease. And this is potentially really important. So this study is the first to show that the technique can be safe and effective if these CRISPR-Cas9 components, which in this case we're targeting a protein that's made mainly in the liver, if they're infused into the bloodstream. So in this trial, six people with a rare and fatal and pretty awful condition called transthyretin amyloidosis received just one treatment with the gene editing therapy, and all of them experienced a drop in the level of a particular misshapen protein that's associated with the disease. And those who received higher doses tested and saw levels of the protein, which is called TTR, decline by an average of about 87%.
Wow.
Which is pretty huge. Now, previous results from CRISPR-Cas9 trials have suggested that the technique can be used in cells that have been removed from the body, but this is the first time, and to be able to edit genes directly in the body would open the door to treating a much wider range of diseases. So this disease, transthyretin amyloidosis, if I say it enough, I'll say it right.
Yeah.
Is caused when molecules of TTR fold, this is the protein, fold into the wrong shape and sort of clump together, and they form fibers that interfere with organ function. It is a disease that principally attacks the heart and nerves, and a hereditary form of the condition affects about 50,000 people worldwide, and more than 100 mutations in the TTR gene have been linked to transthyretin amyloidosis.
You got it that time.
I did, yes. It's pretty awful. The condition can cause heart disease, pain, and ultimately death. Until recently, there was very little that doctors could do to treat it. But it's become a prime target for new technologies that aim to disable disease-causing genes because it's definitively linked to a production of this particular protein. And if you shut down production of that protein and disease symptoms can stop progressing and in some cases can reverse. Most of this protein is produced in the liver, which is an organ, luckily, that readily soaks up medicines from the blood. And that's really important because although this CRISPR-Cas9 treatment is potentially held as revolutionary, it has its limitations. The technique requires a DNA cutting enzyme, which is the Cas9 part, and a piece of RNA called a guide RNA to direct it to the proper place in the genome. And these have to be packaged in such a way that shields them for degradation. Once they're floating around the body can rip them apart and 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 uh, and they become useless. So the company that did this study encased the molecules in nanoparticles made of a biomolecule called a lipid, and those things are soaked up by the liver. And so the guide RNA sends the Cas9 to snip the TTR gene. The cell's DNA repair processes then mend the break, but often make mistakes that can disable the gene and halt production of the TTR protein. So a month after the treatment, the TTR production was reduced in all participants, and in one person in particular who received the higher of the two tested doses, it fell by 96%. And that's a result that they find particularly exciting, because when you get that high, it really means you've modified the disease. And the body then has a chance of cleaning up and recovering.
Same.
So it's potentially a really interesting and revolutionary treatment, but being able to do this directly in the body is pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, lastly, we're talking about we're going to talk about the Dragon Man, which has been taken up by mainstream media a lot lately because it's such a cool discovery, a new type of human to a point.
Possibly.
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 There's some indications that it could be, and some indications that maybe it isn't. So there's actually two. We're going to talk about two different sets of fossils that were found, one in Israel and one in China. And the Chinese specimen is this Dragon Man, but both could belong to new types of ancient human. But there's a lot of debate about this. So the fossils date from about 140,000 years ago, both of them, and they're adding to the ranks of hominins that sort of mixed and mingled with early modern humans. Now the fossils from Israel hint that a previously unknown group of hominins proposed to be direct ancestors of Neanderthals might have dominated life in that region, in the Levant, and lived alongside Homo sapiens, i.e. us. And at the same time, researchers in China, they're studying some a well-preserved human skull, which was found in the 1930s, and they've controversially classified that as a new species and called it Dragon Man. And that might be an even closer relative to modern humans than the Neanderthals. But like I said, there's a lot of debate. These studies are based on analysis of size and shape and structure of fossilized bones, which are methods that are subject to individual judgment and interpretation. They, as always in these situations, there is no DNA evidence at all.
Yeah.
It's all gone. So talking about the Israeli find, since about 2000, this picture of human evolution has become more and more complicated. And there's a whole bunch of species that have lived in the middle and late Pleistocene, which is the Pleistocene era, is from about 2.5 million to about 11,500 years ago, and that spans the sort of the most recent period of glaciations. And there's a whole bunch of species discovered in Indonesia, in Siberia, in East Asia, and South Africa, and even in the Philippines more recently, that are sort of complicating the picture. And they all overlapped with modern humans, which are thought to have emerged from Africa and spread into Israel and other regions about 200,000 years ago. And they also overlap with Neanderthals, which were in Europe around 300,000 years ago, and were outcompeted or subsumed into modern humans by about 40,000 years ago. But there are hominin fossils that don't fit into existing categories, and both of these are potentially those like that, and they can be reclassified. So, in the Israeli find, only conventional thinking was that only Homo sapiens lived in the area at the time of these that these bones were dated to, and Neanderthals weren't there for another about 70 or 80,000 years. The jaw and the teeth were Neanderthal-like, but the skull shape was more archaic, which is apparently an unusual combination. But I think we're sort of running short of time here, but I think there's a lot of discussion and controversy about exactly where these bones fit, The size and the shape of them indicate maybe early Neanderthal species rather than a different Homo, another sort of hominin. So the skull looks like an early, rather archaic appearing Neanderthal. And ultimately, some of the researchers who are commenting on this suggest that maybe we should just start from scratch. The current homonym classifications, this is one opinion, make little sense because they bundle too much diversity together into species such as Homo sapiens. And I think this person thinks that we should start from scratch and start to reclassify things according to the most recent data and the most recent finds, and maybe we come up with a different classification of species rather than what we have now.
Sweet. Well, that was Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.